Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work. And today, I'm so excited to have the writer, producer, actor, Cleopatra Coleman on. Hello.
Hello.
For those of you unfamiliar with Cleo's work, please let me give you an introduction. Cleo is an Australian actress of Scottish and Jamaican descent who grew up in Byron Bay, New South Wales. In 2004, she was cast as Zandi Brokaw in the Australian children's science fiction series Silver Sun. But her career has spanned 15 years of film, television, and theatrical productions, both in Australia and the U.S. In the U.S., she starred with Will Forte in Fox's critically acclaimed hit comedy, The Last Man on Earth. On June 29, she stars in the sci-fi films and Snowfort Pictures release Hover, which she also wrote and produced. Hover tells the story of a woman uncovering a conspiracy between the government and corporations that murders unsuspecting citizens in a not-too-distant dystopian future. Cleo will next appear in the sci-fi comedy film James vs. His Future Self alongside Daniel Stern and Jonas Chernick. That movie will tell the story of an uptight but brilliant scientist on the cusp of becoming the world's first time traveler who finds himself tormented by his unhinged future self who wants him to give up his dreams and have a normal life. When James won't go along with the plan, it becomes a wicked battle of man versus himself. So that's the primer on Cleopatra Coleman here. So I'm... The movie that she chose to talk about today is so apt, not just for the world, but also for her film Hover. So we get to get into that quite a bit. And what she chose today to talk about is Children of Men. Can you give me just a quick idea of maybe why you chose that movie to talk about today?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think it's a perfect film. I mean, I've always thought that since I first saw it. And it's so topical. And, like, when I rewatched it for this interview, I was floored. I haven't seen it since the Trump administration. I haven't seen it even since I really have been like full-time living in America. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. It's almost as though, you know, he was predicting the future, and this was made in like 2006. I absolutely love this movie.
Okay, we are going to get into that prescient quality of the film in the discussion. But for those of you who haven't seen Children of Men, today's episode will give you some spoilers, as always, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Again, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and peep Children of Men first, this is your chance. Now let's introduce Children of Men. Here's a quick synopsis for you. Directed by Alfonso Cuarón and written by a handful of writers, including Cuarón, Timothy Sexton, David Arada, Mark Fergus, Hawk Ostby, and even Clive Owen, Children of Men stars Owen as Theo Farron, a former activist turned cynical bureaucrat. It's 2027. The world is in turmoil, and the youngest person in the world has just died at the age of 18. The police are militarized, caging up and killing immigrants right on the street, and Theo gets a sudden contact with his ex-love Julian, played by Julianne Moore. She's an activist on the run trying to get an immigrant woman travel papers, and she asks Theo to help. He agrees, but only after taking a large sum of money for the job. He travels with the activists, but Julian is quickly murdered in a guerrilla attack, and the immigrant woman Key, played by Claire Hope Achete, reveals to Theo that she is about 9 months pregnant, and that's why he needs to get her to a boat that will take her and her baby to safety. Theo realizes he can't trust any of the other activists who plotted to kill Julian, and that he alone must take Key to the boat. On the run, Theo slowly drops his cynicism and his flip-flops as he realizes that the fate of the world is in his care, and he's living for a bigger purpose now. Key gives birth, and what follows is one of the most significant single-take action sequences in cinematic history as Theo risks everything to save Key and the baby in a war-torn refugee camp. That's it. But it's so much more than that. Every frame is so much more than that. What do you think, what's the most resonant part for you watching it again?
I mean, I was really struck by the very opening of the film where you see a bunch of extras, people that you're never going to see again in the movie, huddling around a television because baby Diego has died, the youngest person on the planet, and then you have your lead, Clive Owen, Theo, walking through them.
Baby Diego was stabbed outside a bar in Buenos Aires after refusing to sign an autograph.
Witnesses at the scene say that Diego spat in the face of a fan who asked for an autograph.
He was killed in the ensuing brawl. The fan was later beaten to death by the angry crowd. Born in 2009, the son of Marcelo and Silvia Ricardo, a working-class couple from Mendoza, he struggled all his life with the celebrity status thrust upon him as the world's youngest person.
Diego Ricardo, the youngest person on the planet, was 18 years, 4 months, 20 days, 16 hours, and 8 minutes old.
I mean, God, it's some of the best extras acting I've ever seen in my life. And obviously you'd want that.
Yeah.
For your opening, it's just such an incredible movie. It has so many moments that captured me. I mean, whether it's those big long one takes or just like the editing, the way that the title comes in, God, that car chase that's like 4 minutes long, that one take, obviously that's one of the most incredible parts of the movie. But it's one of those movies, it's really hard to pick anything to focus on because everything's so amazing. But I think that from the beginning, I mean, obviously it tells you it's supposed to be London 2027. You wouldn't even need that because they do such a good job of showing you exactly what time it is. It is not right now. It is like seconds from now. It's everything you're familiar with, but it's just a little bit further ahead in time. And it's bleak.
Yeah.
And it really sets it up so well. So I guess I have to say the opening. Yeah.
The opening is a really interesting thing to bring up because one of the things with that opening, if people remember correctly, there is a bomb that goes off right next door to where Theo is exiting a coffee shop after he's just heard about baby Diego. In the time that they were shooting this, there actually were two bombs that had gone off in London.
Yeah.
And Cuarón was quite worried that the Americans would end up stopping the production because they would be scared. But then he realized that Americans still find London as a safe place. Mm. Like they think that nothing can happen there, even though things are happening there, which is an interesting thing. And it plays with the tone of the film, too. You know, like nothing can happen here. It's fine.
Yeah.
Even though things are happening all around these characters.
Right. You see all that like pro-Britain propaganda on the buses of like, you know, they show all those clips of every other city in the world is completely messed up. But Britain, you know what I mean? It's like, it's so interesting what he did there.
Okay, so here's the thing. Both your movie and Children of Men, they have those kind of, and I don't even want to say prescient because these are things that are already happening. And that's what Cuarón talks about a lot in his interviews where he's just like, no, all of this stuff was happening. It's just that people, you know, they didn't really care. And the things that you're talking about, whether, you know, agriculture and kind of like this big ag being taken over, not necessarily by people, but by technology. I find that very interesting. And one of the quotes that Cuarón had said when he was like, no, this is happening. He said, the thing is that it was so obvious already then in the early aughts, but it needed to be so gruesomely obvious before the media would notice. Just think about for how long it was horrible before it became horrible to the media. This was...
Wow.
So it was one of those things where this movie actually tanked at the box office. And it's hard for me to remember that. I remember... seeing it, I think, when it opened in the city that I was at. But it tanked there because it opened up on Christmas Day.
Mm, yeah, no one wants to see that.
No. And, you know, it's Christmas Day, and here Cuarón is saying, no, this is urgent, but people, they just weren't listening. And, you know, again, you find people who are listening now. And it seems like maybe your movie is sliding in at a time where people are actually paying attention to these things and are receptive to it.
Sure.
I mean, what was on your mind when you were writing this?
Oh, man. Just watching the news, the state of the world. I read an article about an assisted suicide organization that exists in the world. And
because Cleo's character in the movie is I mean, is it like a government position, it seems
like? She works for an assisted suicide organization.
Yeah.
It's a nonprofit organization, but again, that gets a little gray in the film, and that's part of the story. But yeah, I read this article about what it means to actually volunteer for one of these companies and what it means to be on one of these lists and wait for years and years to be allowed to kill yourself if you're terminally ill, and you have to prove that you're terminally ill, at least in most places. And I just thought, what's it like to be one of those people? What's mm-hmm. it like to wake up and go, okay, I have an email. I have to go to this town. I have to travel to this town. I have to stay in a hotel. I have to go meet this woman. I have to show her how to do it. We have to provide a mask. There's a certain company in California that manufactures these silicone masks.
Oh, that's interesting, specifically for this purpose.
Yeah, and you know, what does that mean? To actually go through with that. And I think that there's a lot of stories, there's a lot of movies potentially in that subject matter. But what I got from it was, what would it mean to be a young woman who does this for a living, traveling to a very strange town and assisting someone to their death, and then, you know, finding out that maybe she's pregnant, and then, you know, mm-hmm. not to spoil it, but it's not a major plot point. But, you know, it was about that life-death juxtaposition. Yeah, and I think it's such a fertile subject matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's you are talking about that kind of life-death juxtaposition. That's huge in Children of Men, you know. Yeah. Like, this is those two things, they live side by side. And you know, when I think back, actually, this is a good Christmas movie, you know, because there is kind of like the savior that is, you know,
yep.
that is comes out of war and famine and all this stuff, and who could potentially, you know.
It's amazing. God, I can't stop thinking about that one shot where Key, the pregnant girl, she shows Theo for the first time, and she's in a barn, and she's surrounded by all these cows
yeah.
that are hooked up to these machines, and she's like, Theo, I'm scared. Like, they cut the cow's tits off.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. And she's basically saying, like, look at what the world does to things that sustain life. Look at what the world does to things that create life. First of all, no one's creating life anymore. And secondly, look what they're doing to these cows. And then she takes her dress off to show him that she's pregnant. And the shot is just, it's so beautiful. And it's mm-hmm. her surrounded by all of these cows. And it's a very obvious, you know, statement visually to make. But, like, God, she's like the most beautiful cow I've ever seen.
There's like, yeah, there's beauty lighting that comes up
oh
on her.
God.
Like, when she takes off her gown, you know, you can kind of see that she's lit from all around.
Yeah. And she's so vulnerable and she's so good. God, I love that moment. And I love the turn from when she's trying to explain it to him, like, what's going on. He doesn't quite know. She starts to take her top off and he's like, no, what are you doing? And it goes from being this moment when you first see the movie of, like, is she, like, trying to seduce him, or does she think
yeah.
that she needs to do something with him in order to get help from him? And so he thinks the same thing. And then all of a sudden, no, she's carrying a child, and she's potentially, like, she's the only person in the world that is doing this. And it's, God, it's such an amazing moment.
It is breathtaking.
Yeah.
But it is. I mean, it's a Christmas movie.
You keep going back to that. And you know, the barn, Mary Magdalene in the barn.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally.
I can see that.
Yep.
I want to talk about how Cuarón went about making this this script come together, because it took a long time. While he was working on Harry Potter, because he was working on Harry Potter, he had wanted to do Children of Men, and then Harry Potter came up, and so he did that movie. He was thinking about Children of Men the entire time he was shooting that movie, because Harry Potter was so structured. It's such a big budget movie that it's so structured that he knows exactly what days he has, exactly what nights, exactly what hours. Mm. And so he just spent all of his free time researching. You know, he was reading Naomi Klein and John Gray. He was studying populations and trends and Saskia Sassen and Chomsky, just to see how the world's ills would be diagnosed. And he said, quote, "What is great about reading is you read something that's really what you find relevant. Then it relates to something else that then is relevant. It kind of starts to be like a tapestry of information, and everything was around one centerpiece." And I think you can see that in, like, the texture.
Absolutely.
And you said that you were reading these articles about assisted suicide. Did that take you down a rabbit hole into other things?
In a way, yes. But it was also mostly about Monsanto and population control, you know, food shortages, drought.
What was the most surprising thing you read?
I guess how many countries have, and this was obviously a couple of years ago, but how many countries had banned Monsanto while, you know, the countries that I live in and are from are like, cool, like, that's fine. you know, and you, no one talks about it. No one's reporting on it. I found that quite surprising. That's disappointing.
Like, yeah, so that's the big one.
Yeah.
Did you? So you were working on this while you were shooting other things, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so I this is all based on a short film script that I wrote, very simple, just about the lead character and her traveling. And then this agriculture company was sort of in the background, but it was more just about this really weird town and her personal journey. And Sci-Fi was like, we want to make this, you know, for $1 million, which is, as you know, not very much money for a film. We're very ambitious. I was shooting Last Man on Earth, and I got this email. I was in the middle of I was shooting a scene with Jason Sudeikis, and I got this email saying, hey, like, would you want to make this into a feature? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. And so then on my hiatus from Last Man, because we would shoot from August to February every year, I spent that year, that hiatus, writing. And every morning I would just wake up, drink coffee, sit down. I didn't even have an office. I was just at my dining table, and I would just, you know, write it.
It has to be nice knowing, like, you know, for TV stuff, that you have a specific period of time and that that hiatus is coming up where you can actually
do it,
divest yourself from whatever you're doing and just take on the new project.
Yeah, there's no way I could have written it while filming. Like, you can't do a 12-hour day, and you can do little notes and you can, you know, things like that in your free time. But, like, I definitely needed that time off. And I'm really glad I was able to do something with that time.
And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we'll be talking a little bit about what it's like to work very closely with directors. One quick break.
Well, Adam, we're still putting out the Greatest Discovery podcast while we wait for season two.
What are we doing with these episodes?
We've talked to a whole bunch of interesting people, like The Wall Street Journal's Ben Fritz and MaximumFun.org's own Danielle Radford. We're kind of using this time to find ways to entertain ourselves and you while we wait for the next season.
So catch yourself up with Star Trek Discovery and join us Tuesday on The Greatest Discovery. It's on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here talking to Cleopatra Coleman today about Children of Men. Alfonso Cuarón, he wasn't sure that he was going to cast Clive Owen, but the studio had him on this short list. You know how, like, studios are like, these are the people that you can cast. This is, you know, that's all that you can choose from. And it was the one actor that he thought that he could work with. So they did so much preparation together for this film, with Owen even flying to meet with Cuarón and just hang out and talk with him in a hotel room for a few weeks. And the director said, quote, "It's very important he understands the kind of feeling of what we're making. The rhythm of the scenes was on his shoulders because everything was pivoting around him. He's the pivot of the scene, so he arrives and stuff happens. So in many ways, he was an amazing filmmaker. At the end of a long shot, he says, you know, I think we can speed it up. You're going to do that in the, you're not going to do that in the editing room. You need to do it in the scene." And Cuarón also credits Clive Owen for writing as well. I mean, even though he doesn't get the credit on, like, IMDb or something, he's like, no, he did a lot of the writing. And I think that's a really beautiful relationship that you can see. You can feel that choreography coming together in this film. And you have to have that when you do these long shots.
With the camera work. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Now, I'm curious. So this you wrote and you produced and you starred in Hover, but you also had to take a step back for directing and just collaborate. What was that process like for you?
Well, luckily, Matt Osterman was, he's a very kind human being, very understanding, very respectful of what I had written, and was just genuinely jazzed about it. And I think he really liked the vision. You know, it was the most collaborative I've ever felt on set. I almost felt like, in a way, I was able to deconstruct filmmaking in my mind. I got to see so many things that you don't normally see as an actor when you get hired.
Like what?
To come, well, for instance, a rough cut. I'd never seen a rough cut before. And I'd been warned, you know, when I told director friends or producer friends, like, you know, I wrote this movie, I produced it, and there's a rough cut coming to me soon. They were like, okay. You need to know you're going to watch this and you're going to feel like you've made a huge mistake.
Yes.
And that it is trash and that you're going to have to start all over again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And I think because of that, I was pleasantly surprised in a way. I mean, it was rough, but at the same time, I knew it was going to be feeling like it was really bad. So, yeah, seeing that was really interesting. Seeing myself in a rough cut. My performance in a rough cut was really interesting. And there's just, you know, you get exposed to things. Like, as an actor, I feel like, you know, you don't get to see everything. And there were discussions going forward during production, like, how much does Cleo want to know? Because she's the lead of the film.
Mm-hmm.
We want to protect her and have her just sort of focus on that. And then I was sort of like, no, like, I want to know everything because I want to do this again and I want to learn everything that I can. I've been doing this 15 years. I think it's time, you know, I think I can handle acting as the lead in the film and also, like, being told, like, this didn't show up today or the generator's not, or, like, what, you know, whatever is going on. Or how about this prop? How about that prop?
And, yeah.
I really, really enjoyed that. And, Matt was really great and really collaborative. And, you know, it was cool being able to be out in the middle of Baton Rouge or, like, another town next to Baton Rouge, Zachary. And we're filming in this house, this old Freemason's house. And we know we have this chase scene with a drone coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be in a forest. And Matt was kind of feeling like maybe we want to do it under this house because we discovered this house. And it had like a, you know, because it floods a lot there, they had like a kind of a tall underneath of the house. And maybe it could be like a cat and mouse situation where there's a drone around a corner. She's hiding behind wooden beams, things like this. And I was like, yeah, cool. But how about, you know, this forest? And he was like, it's too thin. So then I'm like looking around this property and I see this like swampy mound of forest in the middle of this farmland. And myself and Kim Barnard, our female first AD, who is amazing, we all walked out into this forest and checked it out. And Matt was like, you know what? I think you're right. I think we need to shoot out there. There were some snakes. There were some things going on. But I was like, it's worth it. I want it to be in a forest. I want that juxtaposition of technology and nature. And I was really lucky that even though that wasn't what Matt initially wanted to do, he was cool enough to be able to see the value in that. And like, we went ahead and we shot it there.
One of the things that is so, so important about this is the background stuff. And I want to talk about those background actors because you had mentioned it and I want to draw some attention to it. Because unless you're watching the subtitled version of this film, you might miss some of the very telling details. When we see all the people lined up on the street in cages while the Britons just kind of go about their day, it's in one scene, Quaron had a German woman, mm-hmm. like a white German woman mm-hmm. screaming in German, quote, how can they do this to me? How could they keep me up with all these? How could they keep me with all the blacks?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this, like, not only a system where those at the top are oppressing those at the bottom, but those within those bottom rungs inside literal cages are oppressing one another.
Mm.
And Quaron was careful to make sure that they had these exact numbers of specific extras from every culture and race, because he wanted to make that point that all humans are migrants with no attention paid to their skin color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why on the surface, this film might even seem like, quote unquote, post-racial, you know?
Sure.
It's not. It's just that Quaron isn't necessarily addressing the issue directly. And I'm curious, when you're making kind of a future film, you get the choice to be like, do we address race and racism as it was in that day? Do we say that it has changed? You look at something like The Handmaid's Tale, where they're like, well, at first they were like, well, we're not really going to talk about it. And so, you know, what was your thinking in your film? What did that cross your mind of like how you were going to portray that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm biracial, so it never doesn't cross my mind. But I wanted to create an inclusive world. And that meant for me gender, race, ability. So we have people of different abilities. We have people that look different. We have people of different races. We have, you know, we looked at a lot of different actors for a lot of different parts. And a lot of the time we were looking for people of color. And I'm really happy with the way that it rounded out. But we didn't want to make it a statement,
yeah.
But we wanted the casting in itself to be a statement. I mean, the lead, obviously, if I'm the lead, which I am the lead.
You are the lead.
I am. Obviously, I'm a person of color from another country. Specifically, I'm biracial, which I always love. I think it's, again, like a really fertile subject matter and something that doesn't get talked about a lot. I think in earlier drafts, there might have been a little more on that side for Claudia, but it's such a big subject and we have big themes already. So mm-hmm. we kind of just let the statement be what it is in the casting. But it is something that I'm dying to talk about in writing in the future in film, just from my own perspective.
Would you do any more futuristic stories?
Oh, yeah.
You think?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I'm already writing one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Sci-fi is my favorite thing in the world.
Well, you all, like, Last Man on Earth is also...
It's a sci-fi comedy.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, I think we forget about that just because it's, you know, it's like an ensemble, you know, feels very light at times, but isn't, but...
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of it is that, you know, we're not afraid to delve into the realities of what it means to be living in a post-apocalyptic world and then juxtapose that with, like, all this really silly stuff. The tone was really well done.
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
Such a strange, beautiful show.
Yeah, very special.
Oh, man. I want to get into a little bit about the levity, though, of some of these films, since we're already talking about comedy. Because I was a little bit surprised rewatching this that there were some parts that were genuinely funny. Like,
yeah.
Michael Caine's
oh my God.
Role... is hilarious.
He's so great.
And he based his character off of he had known John Lennon.
Oh.
And so he was like, I'm going to be what John Lennon would be if he had grown old.
Wow.
And so this is going to be him
cool.
in this old house.
Yeah, he's great in the film. I love that there's a moment where Theo takes Key to Michael Caine's character's place and he's asleep in a chair. And we've seen all these ads, because you were talking about background, we've seen all these ads for this company called Quietus.
Yeah.
Which is very, obviously, very much like Hover, like
yes.
the company that my character works
yes.
for in Hover. And it's like, you know, you see these ads, take a pill and go when you want. You know, I think the tagline is something like, Quietus, you decide when.
Oh, my God.
It's amazing. And so he approaches Michael Caine. Michael Caine has a quietus box next to him. He's asleep in this chair, and he's like, oh, my God, no, he's done it. He's killed himself. Of course, no, he wakes up from a nap, which is, like, the most hilarious part of the movie. So, oh, no, I was just asleep. And then he's like, why do you have that stuff next to you? Why do you have the quietus stuff? And he's like, oh, I like to use it. I put it with bread and give it to the rats. And I thought that, like, it's funny, but also, like, I was like, oh, shit, this is like such a great analogy for population control.
Yes.
Because for the whole movie we've been seeing these ads. Like, I think it was like 11 minutes in, you've seen like three or four ads for Quietus in the background.
Yes.
It's so cool. Wow.
I mean, it's an interesting art being able to do kind of fake advertising.
Yeah.
In movies. And I know that you have that in Hover. In fact, you yeah. start with that.
Yeah.
And that's like, because you have to come up with a slogan. And yep. that slogan is so good. The Quietus, I didn't even catch yep. that. I didn't yep. even notice. And I keep forgetting that was in the background. I don't even think I noticed on the second run,
yep.
this new watch of mine.
God. That is, yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts about this movie. And there's so much I want to say about it. But I remember, like, after 9/11 happened. I was in Australia. I was a teenager, and Islamophobia sort of became a thing,
mm-hmm.
Or more of a thing. And I remember just these, I guess, ads, government ads popping up in public places, like
yeah.
report suspicious activity.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, well, I know that what you mean is Muslim people, right? Like, that's totally like what was going on at the time.
Yeah, there's a subtext there.
Yeah, and God, there's so much of this in Children of Men, and it's just so real. I mean, God. And then you have really subtle things. Like I was saying at the beginning, you have like a regular London double-decker bus, mm-hmm. but the ad on the side of the bus is moving.
Yeah.
Or you have Clive Owen's character running through an area and you see a newspaper stand. Everything's normal except the picture and the newspaper's moving.
Yeah.
Like Harry Potter.
Yeah, maybe he got practice. Like he was just like, yes,
good
I see.
Idea. And I think like a really interesting way to sort of track where we're at as a society is to see how the people who or the companies who want to make the most money from us, how they speak to us. Because like in movies like Minority Report and like in Children of Men, you see that advertising just becomes more and more intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has now. Like you know, you Google something and then all of a sudden, like, you know, they're trying to sell you. Like if I buy something online, I will get all these ads telling me to buy it again.
Yes.
Or like, you know, weird Facebook. I don't have Facebook anymore, but like, you know, Facebook does that a lot.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And so I love what he did in Children of Men with the advertising. That was my favorite thing. And so in Hover, I really, really wanted to hone in on that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a moment after she finds out she's pregnant. She's at work and her phone dings and she's expecting to hear from someone and she looks down and it's not the person she was wanting to hear for. It's an ad telling her to buy, you know, fertility vitamins or something
to help her
pregnancy. You know, just because her phone has heard her say it or perhaps the pregnancy test she uses synced up now to her cloud or like whatever it is. Like I love that. And then also, like, on the Paul Verhoeven side of things, we have these, like, running ads.
Yes.
Yeah. Would you like to know more? Like, that's, like, my favorite part of Starship Troopers. And so we wanted to implement that as well. And, like, it's supposed to be fun. Like, you know, everyone wants to take their medicine with a bit of sugar. And I feel like with Hover, we were really obviously trying to make a statement. It's a dark, dark world. It's very bleak. But at the same time, like, there's a little bit of fun there. I mean, it's like drones running around in the sky. You know, like, you can't take it too seriously. But at the same time, like, there's a definite message behind it.
We're going to take a quick break, but then I'm going to come and we'll talk about the technical aspects of those long shots, specifically with regard to that last very famous fighting scene. So one quick break and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the hosts of Everything's
Coming Up, Simpsons.
Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D-, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
Homer wearing that golf outfit is so funny.
It.
And there's when he gets super into golf, he's wearing the golf hat in
bed. We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, that's no surprise because it's The Simpsons. But, I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point have been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Smell you later.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here with Cleopatra Coleman talking today about Children of Men. So we were talking about the complications of making those, you know, one-shot scenes that are just amazing. So let's talk maybe about some happy accidents that might happen on set. You were asking, you know, like, I wonder how many times they had to do the car scene. I don't know that, but I do know that they were only able to do that last, like, battle scene coming out of, you know, the building before it gets shot up. They only did that 3 times.
Wow.
But they had, I think, 14 days to do it. And most of that time was set for rehearsals.
Right.
Obviously.
Well, that's the main, the main thing. Wow.
So they did that, you know, only 3 times, and the studio kept coming and being like, hey, what are you doing? And so they really only had time to do 3 takes. The first 2, something happened wrong, like a squib went off too early or something. Mm-hmm. It just didn't work. On the 3rd take, the funniest part is that Theo goes into like a bus for a second, and there's a moment where blood hits the camera. And apparently Cuaron had yelled cut because he was like, ah, we're never going to get this shot. But right when he yelled cut, another, like a gun or a bomb went off, and so no one on set heard it. So they just kept going, and that turned out to be the take, and it's the whole reason that they were able to keep that shot.
I love that story so much. I'm always talking about things like happy accidents in art or constraints in art. And as an artist, a lot of the times you'll feel like Cuaron and you'll be like, cut, this is not going to work. And you don't realize that like what happened in your story, you know, you're making the art. Like what goes wrong actually influences it in a way that you could never have done on purpose. And then it just brings you back to the perspective of the audience. Like, as an artist, like, I've personally struggled with, I never know, like, as an actor, you never know when you're good. You don't really know. Like, you might be on set feeling like, yeah, I'm, like, I'm fucking nailing this scene. And then you watch it and be like, what?
Did I?
I don't know if I did. Or, like, you know, go to an audition and feel like, man, I feel like shit. I don't think I'm going to get this. And you get it because I don't know, like they saw something for whatever reason, you were a bit looser with it, or you didn't want it as much, and so that did something to the character, or like your eye was flickering in a certain way, or your posture, whatever it is, the energy that you're emitting, you just never know. And I think that is the most beautiful thing about art and chaos.
But did you have any happy accidents on set with Hover or even with Last Man on Earth?
Probably. I mean, with Last Man, definitely there were some one-liners that got thrown in. I don't know. But I know we do have one take situation. It is not a Children of Men level, but it is pretty cool.
What is, though, honestly?
I know, nothing, literally. It's really cool. It's so we had a drone team. Obviously, if you're making a movie about drones, we had a lot of drone POV and, like, we, you know, influenced a lot by Terminator and having the UI and, like, how do they see things and what do they see human beings? Like, what are they tracking? What are they seeing? And so we have this scene where Claudia and Joanna and Isaiah, I'm Claudia, Beth Grant is Joanna and...
Oh, I love Beth Grant, by the way. When she showed up, I was like, yes, Beth Grant!
Yes, and Shane Coffey plays Isaiah. We're walking out of a house, we're getting into a car, and we cut to a drone shot of the car. The drone then, and this we really did this, we take off down the road, we turn a corner as the drone takes off through a field, and then we're like, we're on the walkie, and they're like, come, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. We did this like 3 or 4 times. And then like we turn down a street that parallels where we were before.
Yeah.
And then the drone catches up with us. And then it just like trails us in the distance and gets higher and higher and higher. And that was Matt Osterman's idea to do like a really cool one take drone shot. And I was really, really proud of that. And it was really cool to have a drone crew on set and the things that they can do. And I mean, obviously there's some weird restrictions. I'm not sure. I've never shot with drones before or in any other state, but in Louisiana, you're not allowed to operate drones after a certain time of night.
Yeah, there's weird laws on the books now.
Yeah,
that people,
which is good. I mean, I was in Bali at like this like jungle hotel sort of thing, and it was amazing. But there was this guy with a drone, and I was like, "You're killing my like. This is the worst possible thing you could do.
The beauty of the earth, and then you just like have a drone.
It was
come
horrible.
Up.
We were staying in this like it was an open like." Jungle hotel room, right? There's no walls. So I'm like naked in this hotel room and all of a sudden this drone comes up and I'm like waving at him and I'm like, I'm pointing like, go down, go down. And obviously he was watching because then the drone goes down and disappears. I was like, that's fucking gross, dude.
That's so weird.
Anyway.
Anyway, be respectful if you have a drone.
Yeah.
I know all of you have drones now. Let's get into a little bit about what it's like to be a newcomer on set. Because Claire Hope Ashete, like, this is her, like, first big role that she was doing. And she really kills it.
Yep. She really does. I have a bit of trivia about that.
Let's do it.
So this was 2006. I was living in Australia. I had done like one or two shows before, and they were really searching, and I auditioned for Key.
What?
Yeah.
What?
I got to audition. Before, I had no idea. I was like a teenager. I had no idea what it really was. I don't remember if I was good in the audition. I don't know. It probably like served as like just practice for me. But yeah, I know for a fact they were really looking for, they weren't looking for a name. They were really looking for her, for Key. Who is Key? And she is Key. She is so incredible in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that she was a bit green only lends to the character.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. There's, you know, there are definitely interviews with the actors where they said they were aware that she was very new and this is a huge set to be stepping into. And so they kind of went like above and beyond to be comfortable. Like, mm-hmm. I need you to feel comfortable, you know, because everyone knows that if an actor is comfortable, then you're going to get some of your best work. You know, they can think through it. And so Clive Owen just went out of his way to be like, we're together. We're a team.
That's amazing.
Which I think you have to do that with having a younger actor on set. I can't imagine how intimidating it must have been.
Yes. Yes and no, though, because if you don't really know what you're getting into.
That's true.
Maybe it's just like, and that's how it was for me a lot of the time when I first started acting. Like, I was so young, I don't know if I could start acting now. Like, I you know, because I know too much.
Yeah.
I think back then, you know, when I was 15 when I did my first show, it's just kind of like, I don't know. Yeah, just doing a show. Oh, how many people are going to see it? I don't know. Like, I didn't pay attention. So it was so much easier for me to walk into these rooms and,
yeah, the other stuff you don't have to think about yet.
Yeah, you don't have perspective. You don't have perspective of, like, how hard it is or how lucky you are or any of it. You're just sort of doing it.
Before we go, I want to like leave us off with some just a quick chat about the philosophical side of this, of the kind of like removing the human element from the future and what that means. I mean, what do you think that means here? What do you think that means in your film Hover? Like, what are you trying to say?
I mean, look, we've talked about the technology and how dirty it is. It's like in Children of Men, it's like that's our dirty shame. Like, we tried to be the best. We had people design technology that was supposed to make the world better, and now look at it, it's all filthy and everyone's gross and dying and killing each other. And it's, I mean, the title of the movie, to me, I don't know what, you know, the consensus is generally, but to me, the idea of Children of Men, right? Mm-hmm. The Children of Men are fucked. Oh, we're just so screwed up. It's a movie about the patriarchy. It's a movie about, I mean, it's about so many things, but it's like the children of men are not okay. You know the saying, the kids are all right?
Yeah.
They're really not. And I love that. There's a scene where I just remembered where Theo goes to visit the really wealthy guy.
Yeah.
For Julian to get the travel papers.
Yeah, yeah, his cousin, yeah.
Yeah, his cousin. And there's a pig in the sky.
Yeah.
In all his shots behind him.
Yeah.
And it's like, for me, it's like that saying, when pigs fly. And it's like, and this is then. This is when the unthinkable happens. This is when everything, it's like all bets are off. The craziest shit's about to go down.
And yet, both your movie and this movie still have some hope. There's hope. I want people, you know, when they see your film, it's just like, look, it's a dystopian kind of thing. But there's also, you know, an idea of what the future could be.
Absolutely. And as I said, I based this on the news. I based this on things that are actually going on that I was just privy to and then got a little more into when I decided to write it. I'm scared like everyone else and I'm worried about it. But I also know, like, you know, I have these discussions with my dad all the time. And I'm like, Dad, like, is the world ending? Has it ever been like this before?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah. He feels as though, and not to say that things aren't terrible and like things absolutely need to change, but he likes to always remind me that yes, there have been bleak times before and we just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I love to constantly remind people of this thing. It's called the overview effect. It's something that astronauts experience sometimes when they go up into space, and you know, the pale blue dot, Carl Sagan, it's like the earth is just spinning in the middle of this blackness. And literally, we have each other, and that is it. And then, you know, racial divides disappear, country divides disappear, religious divides, gender divides, whatever it is. And I think, you know, that's a big message in Children of Men as well. When you think about, like, Michael Caine makes that joke about how the benefits of living near a detention center, he gets his weed from them. Mm-hmm. You know, someone like Key is, you know, oh, she's a Fuji, she's a refugee, she's not allowed to be there, and yet, oh, she's actually the only person in the world that can create people. How about that? You know, it's something that humanity, while trying to make life better for themselves in Britain, they're ruining other people's lives, mm-hmm. and yet life continues anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's something that
it's like I life really continues love. Despite.
In spite of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's something that as human beings, we never really learn. And like in Hover, you know, you have all the life, death stuff, you have big agriculture, but then you just have these like personal relationships, and you have at the core of it a woman who is in a rut and mm-hmm. in a way represents, you know, those of us who we see what's going on in the news. We don't do anything about it because we feel helpless, but we're not helpful. I mean, this is very extreme, but I read a quote on Twitter the other day. Someone said, in Germany, we have this saying, if you have one Nazi and 10 people sitting around a table and those people are talking to the Nazi, you actually have 11 Nazis sitting at a table. And so, I mean, that's
complicity.
Obviously very, yes, complicity. That's obviously very extreme, but Claudia does represent those of us that are liberal and that, you know, love to think that, you know, they're on the right side of things but aren't doing the right thing. And so her journey is realizing what she can do.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about all these big ideas and about your movie Hover. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so, so much. It was so good to talk about Children of Men, one of my favorite movies, and thanks for having me.
And can you tell people where they can see Hover?
Yes, June 29th, there is a limited theatrical release, so some theaters in Los Angeles and New York, but it will be worldwide video on demand, digital platforms, July 3rd. So look out for it on July 3rd.
Awesome. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to the writers of Netflix's Lost in Space, Vivian Leigh, Carrie Drake, and Catherine Collins. They are on the show to talk about Jurassic Park. The first one, not Jurassic World. Jurassic Park, Steven Spielberg. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Music Man 1967 says, this is an intelligent and fun podcast about women movie makers talking about a genre movie of their choice with host April Wolf. All this interests me. There are not enough women writers and directors, so I rarely get to hear what makes them tick. The conversation about the chosen movie usually leads to discussion about their creative process. April is a super knowledgeable and fun host. Thank you so much. I followed her here from Who Shot Ya Podcast. Yes. Woot woot. Also on Maximum Fun, if you like to get into movie analysis and love learning about the behind-the-scenes work that goes into movies and TV, I highly recommend this pod. And then Skinny Girl Margarita says, listening to this podcast, it kind of makes me surprised that men can direct at all, since it seems like the everyday work women do, scheduling, getting work done, troubleshooting, staying on budget, logistics, conflict management, etc., is maybe what they do all the time. I also like learning about behind-the-scenes jobs that women do that never gets talked about. I would love it if April talked to casting directors about how to spot talent. Actually, that's a really good idea, and thank you for saying it, because I want to talk to cinematographers and casting directors and costume designers. That is on my list for next year. And then Skinny Girl also says, for example, I was watching Scott Pilgrim, and it's got Aubrey Plaza, Brie Larson, Chris Evans. I don't know how they managed to get every up-and-comer in there. I think the casting directors are all women, too. On that specific one, I believe that is a woman. But men can also direct. That's what I should tell my listeners. Men can direct movies too if they aspire to it. I also want to give a shout out to my other podcast, Who Shot Ya. We're having a live show on July 5th at the Dynasty Typewriter in Los Angeles. We're screening Attack the Block, followed by a discussion of the film. Ricky Carmona will be there. Alonzo Duralde will be there. I'll be there. And we have a special guest, Travell Anderson from the LA Times. Come on down and say hello. Tickets are only $10 online and $15 at the door. You can check that out on Who Shot Ya Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast. And back to Switchblade Sisters business. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.